This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So, I'm going to talk today about Victorian's interest in entranced Indians. And in order to do that, though, I'd first like to explain tell you about two important frogs in the history of Victorian science. And I'm going to do this so that I can explain that the Victorians were interested in the Indians because they were interested in primitivism. And the frogs illustrate this interest in primitivism. So the first frog is described in the conclusion of the spiritualist, so that's a nice segue for us, William Howitt's book called The History of the Supernatural, which was written in 1863. And in 1862, as the medium Howitt concluded his encyclopedic collection of supernatural events, a debate ran in the newspapers about a live frog that was on display at the Great Exhibition Building because the frog was supposedly discovered encased within a lump of coal alive. And so it was in a little cage in the Great Exhibition Hall. In the Times, a geologist demanded that the frog be removed from the exhibit, arguing that it was utterly impossible that any toad or frog could have withstood the heat and pressure involved in the formation of the coal strata, not to mention it was completely ridiculous to believe that it could have remained enclosed in the coal alive for thousands or even possibly millions of years. But Howitt put the frog debate in his history because his history is an attempt to restore belief in miracles. And he put it in there in order to dramatize the extent of the disbelief of his age. He was disappointed to note that the doubting geologist's opinion was backed by other experts, given that the scientist's ridicule, quote, was so utterly in the face of scores of recorded cases of frogs and toads found in stone, coal, and in the heart of trees, with the dates, names, and places of the persons witnessing the facts given at the time. That's why I love reading Victorian literature. There's about four pages in there of descriptions of different frogs and toads and what fence posts they were found in and what rock they were encased in. It's really fun things to read. So he is upset because people don't believe that story. After providing a survey of a number of accounts of creatures found alive within stone, Howitt deduces that if hibernating animals, here's his quote, can live for years excluded from the air in solid substances, why may not this be done in the bowels of the earth for any number of years? So long as the organization of such creatures is preserved from injury by external action, why should they not continue to retain the vital principle for any term of years, however immense? Now, why can't they just hibernate indefinitely for as long as they want? Drawing evidence from a pioneer hypnotist named James Braid's book called Human Hibernation, Howitt further supported the frog claim by noting that humans possess the same ability and cites examples of the burial and revival of Indian holy men. He concludes that the very fact that the naturalist could deny the truth of the frog and the coal, despite the evidence of hundreds of respectable people, is, quote, a melancholy proof of the progress of that paralysis of faith in the operations of God and creation, which is fast ruining the human mind. So for him, this symbolized the lack of faith that the whole society had. Because there are all these cases that prove that this could be possible, so why won't people believe? So alongside this frog that's suspended indefinitely at this kind of base level of vitality is another famous frog. And this frog was one that functioned solely by reflexes. He's the materialist frog without a brain, who rose to public awareness in 1870, kind of a Frankenstein sound to it. In a series of well-known experiments, a scientist named Gultz removed the cerebral hemispheres of frogs and other animals to examine what would happen if the part of the brain governing intelligence and volition, willpower, was removed. The late Victorian physiologist Morton Prince described these experiments as crucial. He assessed Gultz's work as, quote, together with the phenomenon of hypnotism, somnambulism and kindred states have thrown more light on the problems of consciousness than all other discoveries in nervous physiology. And I think it's really interesting what he found out. Gultz found that his altered frog could function by reflexes alone. And so if it was thrown into water, it would invariably, quote, swim like a natural frog, but would keep on swimming until exhausted or till it strikes an obstacle when it will stop. However, if it was left alone, it will remain quiet for an indefinite period and make no effort to eat or move. All desire to do anything is lost. Whatever it does is done only after having been prodded. And it summarizes it at the end, the animal, unless its reflexes are stimulated, the animal without a brain is living, inert matter. I think that's really interesting that they decided, you know, he didn't have any willpower and he would just sit there as living inert matter until it was prodded to do something. And then it would continue to do it until it died or somebody took the frog out of the water. Goltz's frog and Prince's mesmeric spectacles of human automatons were pieces of a central physiological puzzle that you mentioned. Where'd she go? She's gone. At the mid and late Victorian era, how exactly does willpower or the mind correspond with the material reflexes responses of the body? And in 1874, in the Fourth Nightly Review, Thomas Henry Huxley theorized that the results of these frog experiments proved that if animals have volition, it's an emotion that's the result of reflex actions rather than the cause of them. And he extended this deduction to include humans as well. And this is what he said. It seems to me that in men, as in brutes, there's no proof that any state of consciousness is the cause of change in the motion of matter of the organism. And that to take an extreme illustration, the feeling we call volition is not the cause of a voluntary act, but the symbol of that state of the brain, which is the immediate cause of the act. So our reflexes make us do something, then afterwards we label that as our will led us to make that happen. Huxley's materialist conclusion that a human is, quote, a mechanism worked by molecular changes in the nervous system, end quote, was one of several generated by physiologists about the relationship between the will and the reflex. Some of them, like Henry G.H. Lewis and William Carpenter, resisted the final deduction that humans were automatons. But most agreed that consciousness, especially lower forms of thought, could consist of reflexes, responses to external stimuli that followed kind of a habitual groove in the brain. But there were others who were more extreme, like Morton Prince, who agreed that if you assumed that every thought needs a stimulus to set it or a subsequent chain of ideas and reflexive motion, then you're forced to accept the doctrine of automatism. But he concluded, and this is my favorite quote in this whole talk, automatism, after all, is not a very terrible thing. So it's not so bad to be a robot, is basically what he's saying. So I think that these two moments in Victorian scientific history capture for us the Victorian interest in primitive baseline levels of vitality and thought that are manifested through suspended animation and through automatic reflexes, which is what, you know, a hypnotized person kind of represents, this suspended animation, in a way, of their mind, at least, and of reflexive responses. So when the British studied entranced Indians, they assumed that entranced Indians served as a kind of primitive control that would uncover a peculiarly British civilization. So the Indians were considered the baseline, uncivilized, primitive state, and by contrasting them, they could see what made them British, because they were so civilized. They were driven by their scientific need to simplify and isolate causes. And so these explorers are interested in Indian automatism because it symbolizes a mindless, reflexive level of existence that was different from their mindfulness. Now I want to give you some specific examples of what they discovered while they watched Indians. And so I'm going to take you on a brief historical tour of entranced Indians. And the first of the three locations I want to tell you about is the Mesmeric Hospital in the outskirts of Calcutta. The hospital was conducted by a Scottish surgeon named James Esdale, who beginning in 1845 mesmerized Indians in his native hospital in order to perform hundreds of pain-free operations before numerous witnesses. And this was before the advent of anesthesia and chloroform, anything like that. The most impressive of his operations were pain-free removals of large elephantiasis-like scrotal tumors before the advent of the anesthesia. And there's a picture there of one of his greatest operations that he performed. For some reason, I don't know why, a lot of the Indians would delay getting treatment of removal of these tumors. They didn't want to go in to the hospital, so some of them would get to be enormous proportions. The worst one that he cut off was a 100-pound tumor of a grocer who actually used his tumor as a writing desk while he sat outside his store. I just love reading these books. Where else would you hear a story like that? The first patient that he ever had, this is how he decided to start using hypnotism, came in and he gave him an injection in the scrotal area, and it was very painful and inflamed and burned, and the patient was screaming in agony. And Esdale had heard about hypnotism, but had never tried it before and hadn't really read any manuals about it, so he tried to just do it on his own. And the procedure that he eventually started using all the time was he'd have a patient lay on the table with their head here, and the hypnotist wouldn't be wearing a shirt and the patient wouldn't be wearing a shirt, and he would put his hands kind of claw-like, he describes, and go from the back of the head about 1 inch over the body, not actually touching the body, and go right down to the stomach area and do this slowly over and over again until the patient went into a trance. Well, he was successful in inducing his trance the first time he tried. I was upset when I heard that because I tried to hypnotize my husband and I had no luck at all. So I don't know how he got to be so good at it so fast. But induced a trance, and to make sure the Indian was entranced, he said he'd poked a pin into his back, small of his back, and he didn't respond. But successfully alleviated him of his pain and helped him cope with that extreme pain. And while he was asleep, he cut off the tumor. And then when he woke up, he had no recollection of what happened and found that the tumor was gone. So eventually, Esdale set it up like an assembly line, pretty much. At first, he was the one who hypnotized every patient, but he said it drained him, made him exhausted, because it depleted all of his nervous force to do it. So he trained his cooks, the cleaners in the hospital, every person that he could, and they would go through and hypnotize the people on the tables. Sometimes it would take 20 minutes, sometimes it would take 24 hours. But he said eventually every patient would go into a trance, and then he would just go by and cut off all the tumors. So that's how it worked. Esdale's contribution to mesmeric research was to claim that you could induce a trance purely physiologically, that you didn't need to have a mental rapport with the patient, they didn't even need to have their eyes open, that you didn't need to have all of the paraphernalia, like in our display in here you see all of the rods, and Mesmer himself used to use his magic wand, or use different types of ways to conduct the electricity. Esdale said, you don't need any of that. It's purely physiological. You don't need all of the trappings. Now, why are his experiments interesting? One of them is the idea that his experiments acted out a colonial fantasy that the Indians possessed a natural susceptibility to trance and that it could be an easy way to coerce consensus within the colonies. In a typical mesmeric demonstration, Esdale would summon local authorities and then command entranced subjects to perform uncharacteristic behavior, like while they were in a trance, they repeat verses of God Save the Queen, or they would strip off their clothing. In one of the demonstrations, the somnambulants behaved eerily like Goltz's frog without a brain. Esdale entranced 5 men in a courtyard before the witnesses of a reverend and the president of a college. And Esdale was able to invoke what he called mesmeric sleepwalking in one of his subjects. And this is his description of what happened. Number one could not possibly open his eyes, though he understood my order to do so, and tried with all his might. Nor could he walk when desired. But being set in motion, he poked helplessly forward till he came in contact with the wall, against which he bowed his head and then stood motionless. Being relieved from this dilemma and set a-going again, he slouched about a most forlorn-looking wretch till he got embayed between a window shutter and the wall, and there he would have remained till the fit went off if I had not taken pity on him. I read these, I mean, it's hard to, in a way, it's kind of painful to read about these. I mean, it's, in an exhibition room, and he's just treating them basically like my kids' remote-control cars, setting them loose and watching them get stuck, and seems actually kind of cruel. But like the frog, what it symbolized for them was that the hypnotized Indian operated on a purely reflexive level, is completely passive, and he'd lost all of his desire and his willpower. In another experiment, Esdale demonstrated his scientific power to eliminate exotic religious practices. And there's a really interesting book written about the history of mesmerism that you guys might like to pick up if you haven't read it yet. It's by Alison Winter. It's called Mesmerized. And in it, she argues that what Esdale was doing was he was cleaning up the exotic Indian body. I mean, you see in this picture how exotic and grotesque the tumors look. By slicing those off, he was making the Indians look normal again. And that's kind of the way colonizers viewed going into the colonies, to clean up exotic practices, exotic religion, exotic habits, and to sanitize everything and make it what they considered normal. So while he's cutting off exotic body parts, he's also, in this example, he's cutting out exotic religious practices. I'll tell you what I mean by that. In order to prove that his patients weren't shamming their trances, Esdale targeted a subject at the heart of his religious dedication. As he was about to remove two tumors from a prisoner, Esdale noticed that the patient had grown an extremely long fingernail on his little finger. This was a consecrated nail that the patient had vowed to never cut off as a demonstration of his devotion to Shiva. And Esdale reports that he, this is his quote, resolved to get possession of it, if possible, as a moral test of his being insensible, for he would as soon have cut a cow's throat and eaten a beefsteak as allowed me to cut off his nail while in possession of his senses. It's common practice with the Hindus to vow their hair, beards, or nails to Shiva the destroyer in the hope of averting his anger. So while this person was asleep, he cut off the nails to prove that, you know, he was definitely asleep. He wasn't awake. So this removal of the nail demonstrates a colonial attempt to supplant the exotic beliefs or practices of the colonized with the normal rituals of the colonizer. So he removes the exotic body parts, nails or tumors, through his newly sanitized, purely physiological mesmeric process. There's nothing ritualistic, nothing mysterious, no mumbo-jumbo involved in his new version of hypnotism. Despite his desire, though, to remove Indian exoticism, Esdale conceded that the Indian's automatism was valuable in some respects. He was unable to resist the comparative impulse, and he contrasted the Indian's primitiveness to British over-civilization. Esdale believed that all people are susceptible to trance, but that the process is much easier when the subject is closer to nature. And he deduced that pain-free operations are Indians' natural birthright, since they are, and here's his quote, a feeble, ill-nourished race, remarkably deficient in nervous energy. So they're particularly sensitive to mesmeric power. Esdale admits that many of his experiments could only be conducted upon the, quote, depressed nervous systems of Indians. And here's a passage he wrote. The dreadful shock given to the mind under such circumstances, or when a somnambulist awakes and finds himself perhaps standing naked among strangers, an experiment I've often made, is a trial of nerves to which it would be very imprudent and unsafe to subject any but such singularly impassive beings as my patients. Sometimes, however, it's too much for the nerves of a coolie even. In contrast to the unflappable primitive Indians, the civilized Europeans suffered from a morbid irritability of the nerves and mental impatience, both of which resist and neutralize the efforts of nature. And they actually had a name for this problem. They called it neurasthenia, which meant that they believed that people had a limited amount of nerve force within them, and that if you lived too hard or if you were moving too fast, you would drain out your nerve force earlier than other people. So intellectuals were in special danger of getting sick all of the time because they were using too much of their nerve force on their mind and not letting their body have its fair share. So according to that, all of you should be terribly sick right now, because I'm proof that this is not that rigorous of a talk because I feel fine. But in contrast to the simple, unsophisticated children of nature, neither thinking, questioning, nor remonstrating, but passively submitting to his pleasure, the artificial Europeans have forfeited their birthright. And Esdale concluded, if the proud sons of civilization will condescend to return for a moment to the feet of their mother nature, they will probably benefit by her bounties. We have so far deserted nature that in return she has renounced us as unnatural children and left us to our self-sufficiency and artificial resources. So in other words, Esdale concludes that the British could experience a unity with nature and that they could benefit better from mesmerism if they would only, quote, lose their minds. So just briefly now, I'm going to go to the second and third locations in Victorian history to find discussions about entranced Indians. And they're located in the Comparative Histories of True Religion, books that tried to prove that hypnotism or the spiritualism or religion was true by looking throughout all of history and throughout all different types of cultures to prove that the same kinds of things existed in other places but under different names. One of them is by a German mesmerism historian named Joseph Ennemoser, who wrote a book called The History of Magic, which was translated into English in 1854. And the other is the spiritualist William Howitt's History of the Supernatural in 1863. These histories of trance phenomenon are like the precursors of comparative anthropology. They begin by collecting accounts of trances in the Bible and the Apocrypha, and then they expand throughout the continents and across time. Now, Ennemoser searched for naturalistic explanations to explain away false, over-enthusiastic religious experiences. He assumed that the truly supernatural revelation is unique, and all false religion is the same and can be grouped together under some kind of common natural explanation. His main argument was that visions and ecstatic trances were stimulated by aestheticism, by like fasting, things like that, were merely physiological, and so they were artificial. More often than not, he clarified, mesmerism was caused by magic, which he defines as the key to the hidden mysteries of nature. So magic for him equals some kind of natural explanation that isn't found yet. Rare experiences of true mysticism occur only when the mind connects directly with God. William Howitt, who translated Ennemoser's history into English, took a lot of his original material and then expanded on it to make his own history of the supernatural to serve a new claim. He intended to demonstrate the existence of spirit communication in all places and all times. And in the history, he aims to normalize the unusual practices of British spiritualists by universalizing them. Everybody's doing it, so it's normal. He labeled those who do not believe that these widespread ecstasies and clairvoyant visions and prophecies from God are, quote, misbirths of humanity who are defective in spiritual vision. For both of these historians, Indians were particularly intriguing because of their aesthetic withdrawal from the rest of the world. And as I mentioned in the introduction, Howitt linked these extended trances of Indians to the frog found suspended in the coal. In both of these histories, the image of the entranced Indians offered an odd promise that an enduring primitive vitality could be derived from transforming oneself into an automaton. So it's a good thing. Ennemoser's history characterizes the Indians as sleepwalking children who are oblivious to the external world around them. And this is a quote from Ennemoser. He says, "It's of little consequence whether we regard the East as in its infancy or in its old age. It is in a second childhood in which no active conscious mind is dominant, but rather the instinct of a dreamy existence. There's no spiritual progress, no reflection and speculation in science or nature or religion or legislation. The religion of the mind and the inner life are the leading features of its existence. Cut off from the light of day and the mutual intercourse with active nations, the Oriental is sunk in a lethargic sleep and, as in somnambulism, either a dreaming or a crazy seer, or at the most, an ecstatic prophet." So Ennemoser imagines Indians to function at the lowest levels of thinking. They operate on the level of instinct, never elevating their minds to non-habitual types of thinking, such as speculation about abstract forms of knowledge. So in this scenario, isolation stabilizes thought at its most primitive reflex level. However, Ennemoser continues with the claim that this very isolation can nourish a primitive vitality. For Ennemoser, India's sleepy withdrawal from the rest of the world has preserved its primitive energy and transformed them into a living fossil. He says, "In the East, we find civilization in much the same state as it was at the commencement of the world's history. That is to say, the earliest veracious records of these ancient nations describe their condition much as we find it in the present day. It seems as if the vacillating life of vigorous youth had suddenly crystallized in unyielding regularity, giving forth the light of life in a changeless and uniform manner." So although their culture has not developed, Ennemoser claims that the Indians' regularity and their uniformity and lack of change have saved their vigorous youth. His simultaneous description of Indians as vigorous and sleepy dreamers seems like it's contradictory, but it's consistent with Mesmer's theories that somnambulism could restore the electrical light of life. The Indians might be accused of withdrawing from progress, but that very inwardness generated, for those who believed in neurasthenic critiques, a slow-burning, enduring vitality. Okay, I'm coming to the close of the talk. William Howitt drew upon Ennemoser's image of the Indians as living fossils to contrast their unchanging faith with British progress and British problem of disbelief. As he reflects upon the relatively lethargic British spiritualism movement when viewed in contrast to the more dramatic displays of the American movement, he delivers an anti-modern diatribe, and he decries England's spiritual petrification. And I like any time that somebody gets mad and gives a diatribe, I get really excited. I love to read those kinds of things. So I think you might enjoy this critique that he gives of England and how it's become petrified. And these are all of the reasons why he thinks that England doesn't have any more belief. He says, trade and Protestant abjuration of spiritual relations have been mutually doing the work of internal petrification and ossification upon us. State churchism, sapping the vitality of our consciousness, dulling our religious sensibility, and substituting secular ambition and hierarchic pride for the pure love of Christ and of souls, has handed us over the only two willing victims of commercial cupidity. These, insensibly but rapidly actuated by the wonderful progress of physical science, colonial expansion, manufacturing immensity, and their confluent streams of wealth, luxury, and social aspiration, and our literature and theology saturated with foreign importations of infidel and semi-infidel philosophy, as I read this, I'm thinking, those are all the things I love, have produced a condition of general mind and opinion more destructive to a healthy faith than any period of the world, the most pagan or most corrupt ever saw. In Howitt's critique, England rather than India is petrified. Taking a stance opposite of Ennemoser, he attributes ossification to contamination by the external world rather than withdrawal from it. His Jeremiah declares modern society to be concerned with external rather than with internal sentiments of religion. And unlike the Victorians, who are contaminated by trade in both goods and ideas, the Indians are purified and their faith is preserved by their withdrawal. So, why is it important to notice this mapping of Indians with primitivism? One of the reasons I pointed out was that it helped justify colonialism. Another reason why it was important, because it served as a way of anti-modern protest that protested the problems of modern society and fantasized that they could be like the Indians and be in a more primitive level when things weren't so stressful and when belief was strong. One of the reasons why I explored this is because I read an interesting novel by Wilkie Collins. And in that novel, the Indians are never in a trance, but all of the English are in a trance. And I think that he was trying to appropriate their primitivism for the British. And I think one of the reasons why he did was to justify basically writing trashy books. He wrote books called sensation fiction, which were designed and aimed at reflex level, you know, to stir up your nerves and get you excited, but not stir up any kind of higher abstract level of thought. If being an automaton is a good thing, then reading sensation fiction would be a good thing, and it would be something that they'd want to appropriate for the British rather than the Indians. Finally, I think one of the reasons why it's important to notice these things is that the Indians, for the British, and all of these, for all three of these authors, symbolized the ultimate test of belief. And I will read one last quote to point this out to you. The ultimate test of readers' belief were accounts of Indians' prolonged trances. Howitt reported in 1837 in Lahore, a faker was buried for 6 weeks in a closed chest that was suspended in a vault so that white ants could not devour him. British officers witnessed the opening of the tomb on which the seal had not been broken and watched the careful resuscitation of the stiff, emaciated holy man. He concludes, Such cases of interment have often taken place in India, the tomb sunk into the ground, having been covered with earth, sown with barley, and the barley grown and reaped before the tomb was reopened. To the easily satisfied writer, where it suits him to be satisfied, it would suffice to say, mere jugglery. And, you know, oh, it's just a trick. But this and the like reasoners who leave out their account the ten, but this and the like reasoners who leave out of their account the tens of thousands of cases where most wonderful spiritual phenomenon have taken place and still take place in private families and amongst friends, to have daily conjuring in thousands of sober and unartistic families without conjurers is a feat beyond Houdini, the magician who inspired Houdini. So what he's saying is that these kinds of things have been witnessed by experts, and it's easy for people to dismiss it and say, oh, that's ridiculous, that's not true. But, you know, if you can believe that, you can believe that witnesses have seen an Indian be buried for 6 weeks and come back and not die from that, then you should be able to believe that people can hypnotize each other in the parlor and that, you know, Mesmer could heal someone of blindness. So Indians stand for the ultimate testing ground for what do you believe and what do you not believe. And I think that that probably is one of the biggest intrigues about studying mesmerism, is that this is the ground place where people debated doubt and belief. What can you believe about this? How much can you believe that this would really work? And so I think that as you read through the discourse in these stories, almost all the things that everyone asks is, do you believe that? How could that be? Could that possibly be true? It makes us rethink what our criteria are on what you can believe. So that's the end of my talk.